Hello again, and welcome to another episode of BitNote. This is David Collins, and I'll be bringing you some half hour of great quality video game music and talk about the games they're from. I hope you enjoy. So, one thing of fun things about games, video games, is there's a huge amount of diverse genres, styles, experiments, and what have you. One interesting set of experiments I came across recently was actually stuff composed by Blendo Games, aka Brendan Chung. It says Blendo Games, but it's mainly Brendan Chung. He's created a lot of like short and interesting games, and I believe I even talked about Atom Zombie Smasher on a previous show, which was one of the games he made. But one of the interesting sort of games he made was actually a first-person game, so you see everything out of the perspective of the person, but it wasn't quite straightforward. It was a little arty, I guess. And before I go into any more detail, I think I'll just play some of the title music from the game and have a listen. And that was the main title from 30 Flights of Loving, which was developed by Blendo Games, Brendan Chung, and also the music there was composed by Chris Remo, who, as I played music from him last week, actually. In fact, last week I said I'd get around to playing music from this game, and indeed I did. The fact it's such a short game actually made the task considerably easier, but I had actually been meaning to play it for a while, so, you know. So, what exactly is 30 Flights of Loving? Well, that's actually a good question that I would like to answer sometime. The whole point is, there's actually this web show at the end, called WTF Is, and that is what this game, and it's done by a guy called Total Biscuit, and he does it really good. So, he starts every show by saying, WTF Is, and then the game title, and says, I aim to answer this question across, you know, that's the question I aim to answer with this video show. And so he started up his episode, he played through the entire of the game, and I realized that by the end, he hadn't actually explained what it was, because he himself didn't quite understand it. And that's where it gets a bit crazy. It's not completely crazy or completely weird. You know the way that Tarantino movies, they often throw in a lot of flashbacks, flash forwards, they confuse the storytelling all the way around, and it's not too sure? I mean, there was one Tarantino movie, I think it was called True Romance, where he wrote the entire script for the movie, only it was, you know, jumping around the timeline, flashbacks, flash forwards, you know, interstitching the thing. Then the director took the script and just moved everything into chronological order and then shot the whole movie. And I thought it was a pretty okay movie, and I'm not quite sure what shooting it out of order chronologically would mean. But just because of that doesn't mean that messing around with the timeline of a movie isn't a valid cinematic technique. And apparently, Brendan Chung seems to agree. He made actually, he made a game before that that was kind of a prequel. Actually made a bunch of games that were prequel, but there was a game called Gravity Bone, and it was kind of weird. Everything was stylized. You went down a shaft, you joined a party, you did all the espionage missions, and the 30 Flights of Loving seems a little more of a heist mission, only it isn't quite a heist, because there's not really a heist that you actually see happening. It's gets, and you're not even sure what the heist actually is, and it's kind of hard to piece it together and everything. Yeah, I'm not explaining this very, very well. Maybe I should start on the beginning. It's basically a game, although it's not quite a, even though I've argued about it before, you basically go through a set of sequences, you walk your character through it, sometimes you have to interact with other characters, and by the end of it, you're not quite sure what's going on, and you think your character may have actually died, but you're still walking around in a museum, so if he died, either it didn't stick, or you're walking around in a daydream, or it doesn't really matter, or what. I don't know. I just don't know. It's €5. I'd say just play Gravity Bone because that's free. So play that and see if the style meets your taste, whether you're wanting to get a sequence. You seem to have like two friends who are one of who are helping you in their heist, although the game seems to spend more time with you going to a wedding party with them and getting drunk rather than doing anything other than that. It seems the game seemed to have gotten raved and stuff by all these publications, but I don't know. It's like those times when critics praise a movie and a guy goes to watch and goes, huh, what is this? And it leaves so many gaps, it's hard to even figure out. At one stage, I thought I'd double-crossed everyone, but then I thought, wait a sec, was it someone else who double-crossed? And then someone seems to indicate that, oh, wait a sec, they probably all got shot up by completely different means. So it's very messy, very short, everyone's got blockheads, and I'm just going to play another bit of music now, because at least with music, you know where you are. You know that music is playing and you like the music. It's not trying to... It can be music can be very, very mystical, but then that can be the whole point of time, so it's okay. And there you go again. That is Prelude, also from 30 Flights of Loving, which by Chris Ramo, who of course has also done music for other games, including... and actually, I played a bit of... he works in Double Fine Productions now, which is Gilbert's gig. And I played music from The Cave recently. Apparently he did some co-writing on that, so doing pretty well. But yes, as I said, it's all... The game is short. It's very atmospheric. It involves flying in a plane. At one stage, you go into a bar and you're meant to push aside a picture to reveal a secret passageway. Instead, I got up on the bar and drank every single bottle of alcohol that was perched on the shelves behind it. And it didn't seem to affect me much, and it's because moments later, I'm getting into a plane and flying off to goodness knows where. But then again, it flash forwards to the whole heist going completely wrong, so maybe I shouldn't have completely imbibed such copious amounts of alcohol, or maybe it wouldn't have made a difference. The funny thing is that later on in the game, there's a sequence where you have to drink a lot of alcohol and suddenly you're very intoxicated, which is strange because it was only like a handful of bottles, whereas in the pub I pretty much drank everything on the shelf and seemed fine afterwards. So apparently our character has either a very inconsistent tolerance for alcohol or something happened in the meantime. I don't know, maybe you developed that taste. I assume that the sequence where he drank and got drunk actually happened before the bar sequence. It's all this sort of stuff. Like I said, Tarantino working at the timelines. Okay, just to So that's 30 Flights of Loving. It's a nice game and what have you. I'm going to move on to another song now. This is kind of an interesting one. I've told in the past that one of the reasons that I do this show is because I like to bring out music that's never been on the radio before, of course, and that's never gotten attention or been on the charts. And the last time I told everyone this was when I was actually decided to play a game that, yes, a piece of music that, yes, was on the charts and had been played on the radio. So I'm kind of just, it seems like one of my instincts is that whenever I'm about to break one of my own self-imposed rules or beliefs, that I feel I have to state it out to everyone on the airwaves, and that way it's okay, because at least I've clearly demarked exactly how I'm deviating from my own personal beliefs and philosophies. In any event, I think that this isn't a pretty neat song. It's good. It goodly captures up the time capsule of the era. And I actually personally never actually heard it on radio, so I'm hearing most of the stuff about it from secondhand and various articles online. It was released in 1982. It was by Bruckner and Garcia. And they recently did it. I heard about them recently because they did some of the music for Wreck-It Ralph, which I'll get into later on. And it was based, of course, on an extremely popular arcade game at the time that I'm sure that even most of you have heard, even if you're not familiar with games, you will have heard of. And it's actually a very fun song that sort of seems to sum up a bit of energy and have a bit of fun with it. So, as well as also giving us an idea of some of the impact that arcades had about there. So, without further ado, let us play this Bruckner and Garcia song, Pac-Man Fever.
Out of my mind, going out of
And that was Pac-Man Fever by Bruckner and Garcia, based off of Pac-Man, which was developed by Namco. The song is a bit of a parody of Cat Scratch Fever by Ted Nugent. And also, if you listen to the track, it samples a lot of music from the game itself, which was a lot of which was composed by Toshio Kai. So, essentially, these were Bruckner and Garcia were a musical duo. Pac-Man Fever was probably one of their biggest hits, and they created a lot of parody and novelty songs. And when Pac-Man Fever took off, they took it as a chance to make a whole new compilation album. But the publisher said, "Well, sorry, you know, if you want the album, we want it to be all video game parody tracks." They were saying, "Well, we want to make it like more diverse than just video games." They said, "No, only video games." So they created a whole video game track parody album, and it didn't quite take off, and none of their songs beat Pac-Man Fever. And yeah, it sounds a little like a one-hit wonder. Poor guys. They had a whole career since then, and unfortunately, one of them died. But the remaining member did go on and recorded for the Wreck-It Ralph movie. They created a kind of a movie song that was kind of like Pac-Man Fever, only dealing with the fictional game called Fix-It Felix, which is in the game Wreck-It Ralph. And it was nice and kind of like a good way of talking about, you know, the whole culture of it. Have you listened to it? The song actually has a lot of, really sort of picks up on a lot of the atmosphere at the time. Arcades were new and exciting. I mean, if you look in the last few years, we've got every so often something new and exciting grabs everyone's attention. It becomes the major hit kind of thing, and then gradually it fades. I mean, there's something always, it's never quite as tumultuous as it appears. There's still people who like it, but you know, at some point, you know, it's not going to attract attention just for being what it is. It just either becomes part of the status quo, so it's not really worth paying that much attention to, or it's not as exciting, or you know, basically you might find other things. At the time, in the last time, it's been like mobile phones. I mean, at the early noughties, it was like MP3 players, then it was like smartphones, and then apps, and then of course there was in computers, it was Cloud 2.0, so there's all this sort of stuff. And back in the early 80s, it was arcades. They were the big thing. They were exciting. People went to arcades, people spent money in arcades, people would go in and just see a whole like open thing of all these different arcades and different games, and each one they just put in a coin and would play as much as they can. And that was the whole culture. That was where so much video games come from. And it was pretty exciting. There was a diverse array of games. It led to a whole lot of things, and of course, Pac-Man was one of them. It wasn't that quite successful in Japan, but it became a huge hit in North America. And of course, it was challenging. It was fun. It swallowed so many quarters, of course, because it was popular in America. I mean, I'm sure they had them in Ireland, but apparently history doesn't document the arcade industry in Ireland as well as it does in America. I remember experiencing it, but by then it was more the early 90s, so it was like exciting and fun, but wasn't quite like the intense mania that it seemed to be in the 80s, which I'm really only picking up now by looking at past documents and stuff. But and apparently a lot of people just genuinely did get addicted to arcade games. They'd go in, they'd spend their money and play constantly video games and go back and go in. So, I mean, video game addiction, of course, is a thing, and it is something you have to manage. But, I mean, like, if an addiction involves you going out into a public place with a lot of people around you and having a bit of fun, I mean, it's not the worst addiction out there, I guess. At least you're getting exercise and stuff. But like any addiction, you know, it's up to the person having it to decide how much is this having an influence in my life. Is it too much? And to try to try to get a perspective to decide what portion they want to be in. I'm not even equipped to deal with the wider topic of addiction, but it's just showing, even if a gentler form of addiction where it's just mania, getting crazy, working out the patterns, elements and strategy, and even like getting to know the names of all the individual ghosts and naming them. I mean, even I didn't like that. For me personally, I was never a fan of Pac-Man, and I kind of feel a bit bad because it's such a big game and so iconic. And like, even a few years ago, I was even seeing like one of those lottery scratch card tickets with like Pac-Man logo and branding on it, so it's still popular. But I was just never that keen on the actual game itself. You play a level and it was fun and you kind of got it and you beat it, but your reward was constantly another level. And I mean, I guess I always like games that have an ending, but Pac-Man, and I like to play, music from games that I've actually completed. But Pac-Man, well, it was designed not to actually have an ending. It just got faster, tougher, and kept going. Though in practice, people have discovered if you beat level 100, 256, and if you're into computers, you'll know the significance of that number, that you'll actually be able to break the game so that half the screen goes completely messy and jumble, and the other half kind of stays okay, and you have to try to work your way around it. That's actually something else that Pac-Man referenced at the end of their movie by doing something, a similar crazy glitch with the Disney logo or something. But it's just constantly going around. You have to move Pac-Man, you have to quickly get the pellets. It's strategic. You've got to collect all the pellets, but you got to avoid the ghosts. But they're power pellets that let you eat the ghosts, so you got to know when you can eat the power pellets and get the ghosts, and you don't want to eat them too soon or else you'll use them all up before, and you don't want to use them too late because then they'll kill you before you get to the power pellets. I played it, it's nice, I kind of like it, but it just never addicted me, you know. It wasn't one of the games that grabbed me. And as a gamer, you know, there'll always be games that are hugely popular or even representative of the whole thing that you personally aren't that keen on. And that's okay. All right. So I think in this case, I am going to move across to another track that was actually from a game that also was in the arcades, but I actually liked. And I don't mean that like in a derisive way of, ha ha ha, this is a game that I actually like, you know, all that sort of stuff. No, this is a game that's just that I found fun. I mean, it's not that I don't like arcades. It's not even... But this is a good game. So, I'm going to play some music from Pang. So, have a listen. And that was one of the earliest level, Mount Fuji, music from the game Pang. It was composed by Pierre-Éric Loureau, and it is from the game Pang, which was developed by Capcom. It was originally called Buster Bros, but it was adapted as Pang by Ocean Software. And boy, I mean, when I was playing the Amiga, there were so many good Ocean Software games. I just looked for the ocean and that great big blue logo, and I just knew that happy times were ahead. And this was one of them. Pang is a very nice game with good mechanics. Essentially, you've got a basic bunch of balloons bouncing around the screen. It's sideways. You know, your characters walk around the bottom of the screen. They can climb up ladders, and they can walk and get to higher levels, but they fall down and they can't really jump. So it's kind of, their mobility is limited, while meanwhile all around the screen this great big bubbles are bouncing around, and if the bubbles hit you, you die. So what do? Well, you have a weapon that you shoot up, and once your weapon, that's like a grappling hook almost, hits the bubble, or if the bubble hits into the grappling hook while the grappling hook is still going up, the bubble splits in two. Okay, so what happens? So now you got two bubbles, but they're smaller. So you hit the bubbles again, and then they're small, split again, and then they're smaller. And you hit them again until they're really small, and then if you hit them again, they'll be destroyed completely. And that's what you have to do. I like this game because, like a lot of good games, it's got a good sense of consequences and mechanics. Every time your strategy in order to defeat the game or win the game will automatically cause more consequence. If you go shooting the balloons willy-nilly in a chaotic way, you'll end up with a whole load of chaotic and small balls. So therefore you're in this situation where there might be a large ball and a tiny ball going around the screen at the same time. And you think it's easier to hit the big ball, but if you hit the smaller ball first, then you'll be rid of that and you won't have to worry about it. Whereas if you hit the big ball, it'll split in two and you'll now have two medium-sized and one tiny ball, all to try to avoid that they're bouncing around the the screen. You have to move very quickly, and basically you have to keep destroying them as fast as possible before the time limit runs out. Because, after all, if the time limit runs out, too fast, this is what you get. That is classic speed-up music, which you get in lots of arcade games. They want to give people warning that their time's running out and they got to get a move on if they want to complete the stage before the time runs out and they die. So there's always, often any good arcade game or good game like that has a speed-up music where things get tense. New Zealand Story had a great example of some of that music. The music here I'm playing is from the Amiga version, which of course is adapted by Ocean Software. And also that's probably why I get Pierre-Éric Leroux's music, because apparently some of the original music was by Tamoe Kawata and Yoko Shimura. And if you know Yoko Shimura, she did the composed music for stuff like Street Fighter and a lot of other stuff and done a lot of great composing. But apparently we're not actually playing her music this time. So apologies, but just, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles, I guess. So like I said, it was fun and energetic. You traveled the world in most literal sense possible. You basically had to keep hitting the joypad. You started out in Japan and you ended up in Easter Island. In the meantime, you went through a lot of different stages. And great, one of the great things is the game had a difficulty thing where you could skip some of the earlier levels and go right into the harder ones, which was great because it allowed you to skip the earlier ones, but also, you know, it gave you an extra increase in challenge and didn't have to repeat the earlier ones too often. But there was a fun thing. I learned on a video game show called Bad Influence, which is a British video game TV show at the time, which I loved watching, that apparently there was a cheat that you could use to skip to the end level. And this was by, when the level select came up, typing in, "What a nice cheat." That was it. Now, you had 10 seconds to choose the first level. So it turned out you actually had to type in, "What a nice cheat," in 10 seconds in order to get to the last level. So type in the cheat, get the levels unlocked, constantly hit the joypad to get to the last level, all in 10 seconds. And to my 8-year-old or 9-year-old self, this was actually impossible. I had not yet learned keyboard skills. So I remember distinctly one time my parents had this woman over. I think she was a lawyer. My brother and I got her to come up to my room and then sat her down and got her to type in the "what a nice cheat" in the fastest time possible so that it would unlock and then we'd be able to play, quickly get over to the last level. And we did. And then we went through the most difficult levels of the game in Easter Island, beat the game, and then we were happy with ourselves. So on that note, let me just play a nice good bit of music from the game and talk about how great that game was and enjoy. So this has been, I'll leave you with this music. This has been David Collins with BitNote. Thank you very much for listening.